This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
I think we have to recognize that AI is probably going to be great for some simple functionalities, but you don't want to have AI being used by surgeons to guide them of which way you want to go. You still need humans very much involved.
Part two of our interview with Ed Yardeni is on Consuelo Mack Wealth Track.
Funding provided by Clearbridge Investments, First Eagle Investments, Royce Investment Partners, Baird, Bill Miller, Research Affiliates, Strategus Asset Management, Women Investing in Security and Education, and Matthews Asia.
Hello and welcome to this edition of Wealth Track. I'm Consuelo Mack. What is everybody talking about from Wall Street to Washington to Main Street? What is the biggest phenomenon moving the markets that just about everyone believes is going to change the world as we know it? Well, if you guessed AI, you are correct. Artificial intelligence is defined by the Oxford Dictionary as the theory and development of computer systems able to perform tasks that normally require human intelligence, such as visual perception, speech recognition, decision making, and translation between languages. The term has been around for a long time. It was coined in 1955 by emeritus Stanford professor John McCarthy, who defined artificial intelligence as the science and engineering of making intelligent machines. Can't get much more succinct than that. Well, this week's guest says the November 2022 launch of OpenAI's ChatGPT marked the beginning of the current bull market, but disputes the notion that AI is intelligent. The title of one of his recent morning briefings is AI Isn't Intelligent. He is Ed Yardeni, head of Yardeni Research, a global investment strategy firm he launched in 2007. He's a PhD economist, strategist, and Fed watcher, widely followed by investors and the financial press, including WealthTrack. His firm's output is prodigious. It includes a detailed daily morning briefing and comprehensive What I Am Reading list, his compilation of the most pertinent articles from various news sources. He recently introduced Quick Takes for individual investors, a daily summary of his macroeconomic observations, and he even does movie reviews. He is also the author of several books. The latest, In Praise of Profits, is dedicated to progressives to help them understand that profits isn't a four-letter word. This is part two of our most recent interview with Yardeni. In part one, we discuss his economic and market outlook, why he is calling this the Roaring 2020s. We started this interview with his critique of artificial intelligence. Why isn't AI intelligent?
Well, I think that we have to recognize that it's a statistical model. It's a probability model that gets fed a tremendous amount of information. And based on that information, it develops probabilities, one word following another word, one thought following another thought. And it's prone to making mistakes along the way. So humans have to check, proofread basically what comes out of the AI model and make a correction. So I think part of intelligence is the ability to recognize that you made a mistake and correct it. And I guess over time, AI may have that potential as humans correct the mistakes and teach AI how to do that. But along the way, AI may create a lot of disinformation that will pollute the internet, and it'll kind of feed on itself. And so it also has the potential for really creating kind of a real mess in the internet in terms of just overwhelming it with information created by AI with a lot of mistakes. Think of it as autofill. You know, when you sit on the computer and you type, and all of a sudden this thing's anticipating what you're going to say next, and you make the decision of whether that's correct or not correct. But imagine autofill on speed. I mean, it just wham! It happens so fast that you can't catch the mistakes. Personally, when OpenAI introduced its ChatGPT, right away, I signed up for the $20 a month supermodel. And I said, man, this is going to be great. I'm not going to have to work anymore. It'll write my morning briefings. Life will be great. And so I gave it a whirl. And then I recognized that I had to spend more time fact-checking it and correcting its mistakes than if I just sat down and wrote the thing myself. So maybe it's just too narrow and personalized an experience. But I think we have to recognize that AI is probably going to be great for some simple functionalities, but you don't want to have AI being used by surgeons to guide them of which way you want to go. You still need humans very much involved. As I said, humans can detect their mistakes a lot faster and make those corrections. AI needs humans at this point to actually do that.
So in the 1990s, I remember Jack Welch basically famously saying, if you're not E, you're dead, talking about e-commerce and that businesses had to be involved in e-commerce or else that they would, you know, they basically shrivel up and die. A lot of companies, a lot of investors are saying the same thing. You've got to be involved in AI, you've got to adapt to it. How overblown do you think it is?
So much money is being thrown into this area that there's a good chance that it will succeed in bringing some real productivity gains to our economy. Not that there aren't other technologies like robotics and automation that aren't doing that already. And maybe in combination with automation and robotics and with humans teaching these technologies how to correct their own mistakes, there'll be a lot of progress made. But at this point, I think that giving them too much power over things that could really hurt people is not a good idea, because they are prone to make mistakes. I'm waiting to hear about real experiences where AI has made a huge difference. I thought that self-driving autos was basically artificial intelligence. I mean, for a car to be able to go from point A to point B without killing anybody, without hurting anybody, stopping at red lights, I mean, isn't that artificial intelligence? And what did Apple just do? They said, you know what? We're out of this business. That's, to me, is an indication that it's not that easy and that it's not going to be that miraculous a cure for labor shortages or a boost to productivity. And this is coming from somebody like myself, who's been promoting the idea of a roaring 2020s based on technology. I try to be realistic about these things, and I think right now it's still early on. But it's great. It's great for the companies that sell the chips and sell the servers that you need and the for the data storage. I mean, it's been really good for those companies. But you know, in the late 1990s, there was a technology boom, and everybody bought a Dell computer, put that on their desk, and bought Windows, and it was great for productivity, because output of those technologies increased dramatically. But then productivity took a dive. Well, why is that? I mean, why didn't the technology revolution have long-lasting impacts? Well, because back then, the technologies that were usable were basically Excel and Word. So if you had a lot of people typing on Selectric typewriters, it was a great productivity enhancer. If you had a lot of bookkeepers, Excel could increase productivity. But it turned out it wasn't that useful to a lot of other businesses. I think what's unique about the current situation is the technologies that are out there probably are much more useful and are already increasing productivity. And AI could make a big difference, but I want to see more examples of how it actually is doing that.
So from an investment strategist's point of view, which is what you are among also being an economist, is the market way ahead of itself?
It's really hard for me to answer that question because a lot of very knowledgeable people who follow these companies, industry analysts, have been raising their numbers for the AI companies. And I guess that's a legitimate reason to own these companies and to chase them higher as analysts have been raising their estimates. But I would caution that the analysts have been raising them as the price has gone up. So, you know, we could have a bit of a circular situation here where the stock goes up and the analysts get embarrassed that their number is so low. So they raise their number and then come up with some fundamentals that really justify it. And you're seeing people, including the fellow who came up, has run OpenAI, talking about trillions of dollars are going to have to be invested in this technology. I want to get over that notion that it's just autofill on speed, mm-hmm. that it really can correct its own mistakes.
Let me ask you about a couple of other things that you've written about that are a little bit off the beaten track. And one of them is why economists were so wrong. Actually, the report was why were economists so wrong.
Right.
In a nutshell, tell us why. I mean, in the last go round, you really were not wrong in that you did not think that we mm-hmm. were going to have a recession when the Fed started hiking interest rates. And so why have economists, what have they missed? And you're a PhD economist.
I think what they missed is demography. Demography isn't generally taught in macroeconomics, and economists don't spend much time thinking about demographics. But I have the advantage of being a baby boomer. And when I was young, and just kind of joining the labor force, I came out with a pretty good degree, pretty good education. And I was pretty cocky. I thought I was pretty special. And then I started doing work on economics and trying to understand the economy, and especially focusing on the key driver of the economy, the consumer. And I realized that I was actually not special at all. I was one of 75 million baby boomers that basically had the same aspirations, had the same professional goals. That gave me a little bit of an insight into the baby boom demographics, and some of my calls were based on that. And my call of no recession this time is in fact based on the notion that a lot of the baby boomers, my friends, are retiring, and I ask them what they do all day. I say, well, we don't cook anymore at the house because it's just the two of us. So we go out to breakfast. Then maybe we'll do that at a golf club if they belong to a golf club, or just go to a diner. And then maybe we'll go back home, and then we'll have lunch. And then between lunch and dinner, maybe we'll go see a doctor just to make sure we're still okay. Then we go for the early bird special. So they eat out a lot.
Right.
They go see healthcare providers a lot. And my God, my friends are traveling all over the world. They're taking cruises. And we've seen this in the results of the cruise lines. We've seen it in hotels and foreign economies getting huge benefits from foreign travel. The airlines are absolutely booming. The airports are full of passengers. And so they really have been doing a lot of spending. I've seen a statistic that shows that of all home buyers, 40% of them have no mortgage. And a lot of them are seniors. A lot of them are baby boomers. And so they have a lot of money. And by the way, they don't necessarily have to spend all that money. Some of them can continue to live off interest income, all-time record high interest income in our economy, all-time record high in dividend income. It's the power of compound interest, compounding of dividends. People have managed to stash away a lot of money. $75 trillion is what the baby boomers have in net worth. All-time record high, richest generation ever. Not everybody's doing great, that's for sure. But collectively, we've never had a generation this rich.
So that's the key. That's what economists missed in anticipating that we'd get a recession.
I think that's the key, but I think they also didn't give enough weight to fiscal stimulus, tremendous amount of fiscal stimulus, infrastructure spending, all-time record high, onshoring, spending on building new factories, all-time record high, construction employment, all-time record high. That doesn't happen in a recession. Mm-hmm. The other thing is I've been doing this for a while, and back in the mid-1980s, I think I coined the phrase rolling recession, the idea that the economy doesn't have to fall into a recession across the board. You can have some sectors falling in, some industries falling in without an economy-wide recession. That's what happened in the mid-1980s. And it just dawned on me in 2022 and 2023 that this was starting to feel the same way. Housing was in a recession, but if you looked at it carefully, it was single-family housing. Multifamily was actually doing quite well. Consumers went on a buying binge, buying goods once the lockdowns were over. We all got cabin fever, so we all had to go shopping to get the dopamines going in our brain to make us feel better. We couldn't really buy services because there was still social distancing, so we went and bought goods. And then after a while, we had enough. But what's amazing is we didn't suddenly see a collapse in spending on goods. It just went sideways at an all-time record high. And then people also started buying services. So the recession story just hasn't panned out at all.
Will it? I mean, eventually, right, you're going to have some sort of a downturn. But what's the biggest threat? And I'm looking at, one of your other reports is higher for longer. I mean, you're anticipating that the Fed funds rate actually will stay higher, that you're anticipating that the Fed will not cut, rates as much as Wall Street had been anticipating this year, and maybe not at all. But how much of a threat is that to the economy?
Well, I think when you talk about recessions, you really are talking about the consumers being forced to retrench, and that usually requires
right.
that they lose jobs, and they lose jobs because they cut back on their own spending, so it kind of feeds on itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they've borrowed a lot, that makes the recession worse and could take longer to come out of it and to have a full recovery. I think when it comes to the consumer today, the labor market's very tight. There's a real shortage of labor, particularly skilled labor, and companies are working hard to boost productivity so that they're giving consumers, workers, the tools that they need to become more productive. So I think real wages continue to go up, which is good for consumers. I think in this kind of environment, the big concern I would have is a big spike in the price of oil. Suddenly, we're back to $5 a gallon for oil. And from a geopolitical standpoint, it's not hard to see how that could happen. The Middle East is totally insane. And if it gets more so, it's conceivable that it'll actually impact the price of oil. And if we see a spike in the price of oil, that may start to depress consumers, might depress the stock market, especially as the perception is, oh, here we go again. This kind of the 1970s all over again. We talked about, I've talked about the 1990s, the 1920s, and how this might be a decade similar to those. But it could also be the 1970s still. If we suddenly have a big spike in the price of oil, we had two oil spikes in the 1970s, and if that were to happen again, then you would have a wage price spiral again. So I think that would be what I'm watching the price of oil.
You have been talking about a roaring 2020s in this market, but you've also cautioned about the fact that the geopolitical situation is really reminiscent of the 1930s.
Right.
And how much of a risk is that, and what impact, could that kind of, turmoil
sure.
have on the markets and on the economy?
I do try to combine my background and understanding the economy with a historical context. And history, as they say, doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme.
Rhyme.
And there are similarities during the current decade. Between happier times like the 1920s, like the 1990s. There are also a similarity with the 1970s. We've already had one oil shock. Maybe we could have another one.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody brought to my attention, well, what about the 1930s?
Right.
And maybe that was just such an ugly decade, I didn't want to consider it. But the 1930s were where geopolitics really had a horrible impact the global economy. It didn't happen all at one time. It kind of built up to World War II. There is an analogy in the sense that, we are seeing fascist forces, tyrants, autocrats ganging up together to fight the Western system of liberal politics.
Right,
and,
Russia, China, North Korea,
even within
and Iran.
Yeah, mm-hmm. even within our countries, we see a lot of partisanship these days. So I am worried about the geopolitics, and I'm even worried about the domestic politics. Things are so intensely political about everything we do. And now we're approaching a really important election. They're always important, but this time around the partisanship raises the possibility that things could get out of control. I hope not. Our founders seem to have come up with a pretty good system of checks and balances, but the extreme partisans on both sides, both on the left and the right, they basically want to get rid of the system and impose their will on the rest of us. And so there are some real geopolitical and domestic political risks.
What do you do to protect yourself in that situation, or is there anything that you're advising or doing personally?
It's a tough call because while I'm increasingly concerned about the geopolitical and domestic political risks, I've learned over the years that they, more often than not, when they blow up, when you get crises, you should view those as buying opportunities. You know, even Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as horrible as it was and it continues to be, it actually created a bear market that didn't last that long. It lasted from January to October and created, with the benefit of hindsight, tremendous buying opportunities. And so I don't know that at this point I would do anything radically different in a portfolio. I think it bears watching. So on the geopolitical side, you know, I have the price of oil as a way to monitor how that's all adding up. I can't possibly anticipate when and if China might invade Taiwan. I think China's economy is in such bad shape that maybe that'll keep them from doing that. The situation in Europe remains unstable, to say the least. These are concerns for sure.
And yet, Ed, as we've talked about earlier, you know, there's the melt up, in the Roaring Twenties possibilities, robust stock market continuing, the economy continuing to be strong. As a matter of fact, one of the reports that you've written, you titled "Goldilocks Without the Bears,"
right?
And another one was "Too Many Happy Bulldogs." The fact that things do seem kind of rosy, how worrisome is that from a contrarian point of view?
Yeah, I do have a contrarian bent in me. I don't promote contrarian scenarios just because nobody else believes them. I try to back them up with substantial facts that kind of make sense. But I would say that sentiment is something that I do watch closely, particularly in the stock market. And there's various sentiment surveys that I monitor. And, you know, if I see the market going straight up and at the same time the contrarian sentiment indicators, the one that say that there's no bears left out there, everybody's bullish. And that contrarian indicator in the past has always said, now's a good time to take some profits and lighten up. But the market just keeps going up. It would be very similar to what happened in the late 1990s. The market just went straight up. And there was a lot of bullishness and it just kept going straight up until it didn't. So these are all tools that one uses in thinking about the markets. Psychology matters as does fundamentals. But in the grand scheme of things, history shows that, you know, you got to stick with the market. The stock market over time does generate good returns. And don't get too obsessed about things like the great crash in the 30s. There was a terrible policy mistake of the Smoot-Hawley tariff. That was made back then. I think even the great financial crisis, we had a pretty much garden variety bear market until Lehman blew up. So that was a shocker that the government didn't come and bail them out the way they had bailed out everybody else. So that was a surprise, as was an announcement by an official of the incoming Obama administration that banks would probably be forced to cut their dividends to zero, and so the bank stocks got annihilated. So the government can really screw things up for us, for sure, and sometimes it's not forecastable.
Ed, one investment for a long-term diversified portfolio. In previous programs, you basically said, you know, the S&P 500 and broadened it to the S&P 1500. You're a great believer in, as you said, you know, staying with the market. Do you have another one that you would add, again, to a diversified portfolio?
Not really. I mean, in the sense that if we're looking at global investing, I'd stick with the idea of overweighting the U.S. Relative to the rest of the world. So I think if you're looking for long-term returns, it's still the stock market, and maybe it just broadens out. So instead of the S&P 500, you broaden out to the S&P 1500, which includes the 400, the 600, the mid caps and the small caps.
Ed Yardeni, thank you so much for joining us once again on Wealth Track. We really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
At the close of every Wealth Track, we try to give you one suggestion to help you build and protect your wealth over the long term. This week's action point is stay invested in stocks. Listen to what Warren Buffett had to say in his latest annual report. I can't remember a period since March 11, 1942, the date of my first stock purchase, that I have not had a majority of my net worth in equities, U.S.-based equities. And so far, so good. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell below 100 on that fateful day in 1942. When I pulled the trigger, I was down about $5. By the time school was out, soon things turned around, and now that index hovers around 38,000. America has been a terrific country for investors. All they have needed to do is sit quietly, listening to no one. Well, of course, Warren Buffett did not sit quietly, and he did listen to his late great business partner, Charlie Munger. And we have every intention of listening to him and our select group of really smart and accomplished guests. But at its core, the strategy of staying invested in a diversified low-cost index fund is a sound one. Well, next week, Medicare expert Katie Votava helps us avoid common and costly mistakes with Medicare. In this week's extra feature, longtime movie buff Ed Yardeni shares his favorite movie of all time. Please follow us on Facebook, X, and our YouTube channel. Thank you for watching. Have a happy Easter weekend and make the week ahead a healthy, profitable, and productive one.